Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There is a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. Edward Shannon, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
It is great to be here, Mark.
Edward J. Shannon, AIA, is a sole practitioner architect. He's based in Des Moines, Iowa. His practice specializes in small projects consisting of light commercial, residential, and historic preservation. He prides himself on being a sole practitioner, and he sees the solopreneur model as an asset instead of a liability. Edward was an assistant professor of architecture at Judson University, where he taught professional practice and helped the program earn its NAAB accreditation. And he's recently published a book. It's called The Sole Practitioner Architect. It's a guide dedicated to successful practice as a solopreneur architect. So he's dedicated to this thing, being a solopreneur architect. He's passionate about it. He's a friend of mine. He's been a part of the Entree Architect community for a very long time, way back from when we started, back when it was blog days. He was part of the comments section in the blog. So Edward's been around for a long time. So Edward, thank you for joining us here today at Entree Architect Podcast. It's been a long time to get you here.
Yes. Yep. True.
I'd love to learn more about you. I'd love for you to share your origin story. So go back to where you discovered architecture and what or who inspired you to become an architect, and then share that journey to where you are now.
Okay, great. Well, I'm going to go way back. I grew up in the Chicago suburb of River Forest, and right next to it is Oak Park. Our house was five blocks from Oak Park. We'd drive to my grandmother's house once or twice a week, and we'd go by past the Frank Lloyd Wright home and studio. And my mom would point it out. She would say, "That's a famous builder. His name is Frank Lloyd Wright." And I think she just thought architect was too big a word for us kids.
Yeah.
On my dad's side, my grandfather started a lumber company in 1939. My dad took over the business in the 60s. And so I was surrounded by construction. My grandfather was very successful with the lumberyard, and he built a what I call mid-century modern house. It was two over from Frank Lloyd Wright's Winslow House.
Wow.
Which is Frank Lloyd Wright's first major commission. So my brother and I would ride our tricycles around the planter of the Winslow House, not knowing it was designed by this famous architect. So I grew up Oak Park River Forest, which is an architecturally rich place. But I like to joke, and this is kind of, there's a serious part to this too. The The first time I ever knew who, anyone that was really an architect was from the show The Brady Bunch. And I asked my mom, I said, what does Mr. Brady do? And I was probably in fourth or fifth grade. And she said, he's a modern architect. And I said, well, that's what I want to be when I grow up. I want to be a modern architect, because they'd show different episodes. He'd be, you know, with a model of a building.
Yeah.
All that. So I had this construction background. My dad built an addition on our house when I was in sixth grade. I was out there with the carpenters every day after school. I was just fascinated by the construction, framing, everything. When I was probably a freshman in high school, my dad built another house in Wisconsin, a summer home, and we'd go up every two or three weeks. And I was just fascinated with that. Took drafting in high school, had a great drafting teacher. I'm going to back up for a little bit. Somehow during my freshman or sophomore year of high school, if you didn't want to go to study hall, you could go to the library. And I was not the most studious kid. And I would go to the library, and somehow I wandered over to the architecture section. And my high school, Oak Park River Forest High School, had a huge architecture library selection. Somehow I picked up a book on Mies van der Rohe. I saw the Farnsworth house. I saw just the clarity of his floor plans. You know, I was just mesmerized by it. And I would play with Legos. And I remember going home and trying to build the Farnsworth house out of Legos. Anyway, when we would take at our high school, you'd take a year of drafting, and then you could go into the architecture part. And I did that junior and senior year. The guy who taught, Mr. Urbanik, who taught the architecture drafting, had graduated with a degree in architecture from IIT, Mies van der Rohe School. He had taught there for 25 years. We would have architects coming into our classroom in high school. One guy's dad worked for Harry Weiss and Associates. We'd have people from SOM. We toured architects' offices. He gave us the lowdown on becoming a licensed architect, and that there were three schools in the state of Illinois that had it. He also said something that spoke to me, because I wasn't that studious, and I, particularly my first 2 years of high school, I wasn't that serious. And he said anybody can become an architect if they want it bad enough. And he said, Triton College, which was our community college, offers a 2-year feeder program. He said, we're going to go over there next week and tour it. So he would take, you know, we kind of, as much as we could, thought, you know, we're really exposed to architecture, which I thought everyone in high school had.
Right,
that.
Right.
Exactly. And most people have a shop, you know, instructor teaching them, you know, this. I was able to get a job with an architecture firm the summer between my junior and senior year of high school, because my dad's cousin was a home builder. Got a job with his architecture firm, and I basically ran prints and did deliveries, a little bit of drafting, but it really exposed me to architecture. To kind of a side I didn't really care too much for, which was production housing. You know, they did a lot of spec houses.
Yeah,
they had a few custom homes in the office, but mainly where they're, you know, kind of cranking out these little spec houses. Two of the guys there went to Iowa State University. And after I went to the community college for a year, I really wanted to get out of Chicago. I wanted the university kind of lifestyle. And Iowa State, I visited the school, just kind of fell in love with it. So went to Iowa State for undergrad, graduated in 86, spent a few years interning both in San Francisco and Chicago. Went back, because I just did that 4-year degree, went back to graduate school at Virginia Tech, which really, they taught me how to design. They taught me how to look at architecture kind of formally as a form, you know, kind of a form-centered design, and instead of kind of a plan, you know, floor plan-centered
right. Yep.
Design. They taught me that, you know, and so... graduated from there in 92, right in the middle of a recession. I was all excited to go, you know, back to Chicago. Was hoping to go, you know, work for kind of a small boutique firm. My portfolio really looked great. And it took me 11 months to find a job in that recession. I ended up getting a job with a school firm about 35 miles outside of Chicago in Elgin, Illinois. Growing up in Oak Park, I'd heard of Elgin. I had no idea where it was. But Elgin would kind of come back to me. I worked for that firm for about 3 years. And then during that time, my parents built a house on the lake, and I got to design it and teamed up with a friend of mine who was starting his own practice, and he kind of helped with the construction documents. The project ended up getting an AIA award. It ended up being published in a few magazines. I also went to work for another school firm. In total, I did schools for about 6 years. But the second firm I worked for would get like a custom house every year, and I was kind of their guy for custom homes. By then the economy had gotten better, and I decided, I thought I was ready for a change. And the company I was working for was actually, I was working on a house in Arizona, and the stock market took a dip, and I got a call, and the guy said, put down your pencil. We're stopping the project. And I could just kind of almost see a layoff on the horizon at this firm, because they were kind of notorious for that. So I started looking. And as before the internet or anything, I mean, I would go out in my car and use my wife's car phone or cell phone, you know. Anyways, I decided I wanted to do residential. I really wanted to, you know. And I went to work for a firm on the North Shore of Chicago. I showed them the modern house I designed. They showed me a modern house that, you know, they had designed. I thought, this is great. You know, I'm gonna be doing these modern homes. So I was there, you know, at the end of my first week, one of the principals came to me and said, okay, I'm gonna give you, you know, your own project to work on here. And here it is. It's a Georgian house. And I was aghast. I was like, what did I get myself into? I mean, I thought I was gonna be doing modern homes. And anyways, I started working on it. And the first thing I noticed was I really enjoyed working on a project by myself. In residential, you really think in three dimensions, which you don't always do that with the school projects.
The seeds of that sole practitioner started to take root.
Exactly. And the other thing was, after about 2 or 3 weeks, I started to get really interested in Georgian architecture. And I bought some old pattern books and started to kind of get, you know, interested in stylistic architecture. And my graduate school in particular was very modernist, and, you know, and they did not like, you know, stylistic architecture was kind of beneath them, so to say, but I kind of reconciled that with myself. And I said, you know, I think there's good stylistic architecture and bad stylistic architecture. And since then, I've gone on to say that, you know, modernism is really just another style. So, you know, get over it. You know, whether you're doing modern, neo-modern, it's like I like to call it, or Tudor or Georgian or arts and crafts, you know, if you can do it well, and it's particularly if you can go to the original sources and get your inspiration from there. That was part of my journey. Another thing happened while I was with this small firm, only about a year. They were great with systems. They taught me how to put together CDs. They would give us their proposal, which was actually an agreement, and say, here, you're the project architect. Now, here's the fee. You need to budget this.
Well, that's great.
It was a crash course in business and system. They had some great filing systems I still use today. It was really a great thing. At the same time, this Christian architecture school had opened up a few years prior, Judson College, and I started hanging out there. I applied there. They said, well, you don't have that much teaching experience. We really want to get some guys with teaching experience on the faculty. So, but I would go to their lectures, and, you know, and they would ask me to be on juries and things like that. And they called me one day and said, We've got a course we want to talk to you about teaching, like a materials and methods course. So I went out there, back, and this was back out in Elgin, Illinois, this place. that I had had my first job at. And by then my wife and I had actually relocated to the Northwest suburb. So we were probably about, 20 minutes from Elgin where we lived. And we were talking and I said, I'd really like to teach design studio. And they said, well, what would it take for you, and they said, well, what would it take for you to do that? I said, well, I'd probably have to have my own office, so I could. And these two guys looked at each other, and they, apparently there was a visiting professor who was supposed to come for the following fall and had fallen through. So they both started like talking amongst them. They said, well, he could have Steve's position, And all of a sudden I walked out of there from going to being like an adjunct faculty with one class to being what they said, it'll be a half-time faculty position. And I came home, I told my wife, I said, you're not going to believe what happened, but I got this opportunity here. I can teach half-time. And so I gave the firm I was with, this was probably during the summer, I think I gave them a 6-week notice. I said, look, I thought I'd stay with you guys a lot longer. I'd actually brought in a project for them. So I was kind of worried about that. I brought in a custom home for them to do. I said, I didn't think this would happen, but I got this really good opportunity and I want to go for it. But I'm going to give you, 6 weeks notice so we can wrap up everything, particularly the project I'm working on, because I want the client to understand that, you guys will be taking this over. I'll be, moving on. And then I started teaching and practicing part-time. So I had the half-time teaching. I had the half-time practice.
Was that your first firm? Is that the first
that
time?
That was Edward J. Shannon Architect. That was fall of 1999. And I started, and one of the things I should mention too, I'd been very active in the local AIA chapter. And I'd met a lot of architects. And when I started on my own, I called some of the architects I knew to tell them, and they were all commercial architects. And almost all of them referred little additions and things like that to me. So it was a nice way to start out.
So you're teaching at Judson and started your own practice. And how did that go? What's the story from that point to where you are now?
I did that for 6 years. And I was going to say, half-time teaching. And it actually, I went full-time with the college for a couple of years. And that was kind of a disaster because I really couldn't do the practice that well. They expect you to be on campus 5 days a week and go to all kinds of meetings and stuff like that. So, but even doing it kind of half and half, it was more like, one and a half and one and a half. And there's 3/4 and 3/4. I mean, it was like it was really tough on me. And I decided I went through some personal things. I went through a divorce, unfortunately, and decided it was maybe just time to have, one job and, a paycheck coming from someone else. So I went to work for a design build company, a big design build company. That did additions. That's all they did was additions. They did 350 additions a year. They had a design staff of 65. I was one of 6 senior architects, project architects. I was there a year. This was 2005, 2006. And the phone had stopped ringing there. And their sales volume went way down. And everyone was kind of scratching their heads, wondering what was going on. And turns out I had a friend who was a residential architect. I talked to him and he said, our phone stopped ringing. Like we used to get a call every day. Now it's like once every 2 weeks. We were seeing kind of the beginning of the recession in 2006 for architects. We were seeing the slowdown without really knowing what it was. Nonetheless, I got laid off after being there for a year. Was able to get on with another design build company for about 3 years, kind of a high-end North Shore Chicago design build company. We had a $6 million house and a $4.5 million addition that kept the design department afloat during that time. I kind of managed the design department of seven, and we never broke even every week. So eventually got laid off from that. Now it's 2010. What am I going to do? I'm single. I have no income. I started looking back. I thought, well, I have teaching experience. You know, maybe I can get back into teaching. So knowing that that puts you in kind of a national or regional job search, I did that and got hired by a junior college in Waterloo, Iowa. Moved there in 2010. Taught for only 2 years. Unfortunately, they decided that they were going to abolish the drafting program. So, you know, 2012, I found myself, you know, basically on the street again, on the streets again, and was, you know, just looking for any job, and happened to get a job in Des Moines, Iowa, and moved here. That'd be 8.5 years ago. Worked for the firm for 4 years. Did a brief stint with a kind of an engineering design build company. That didn't work out. And we're almost coming up on it. April 3rd, 2017, I relaunched my practice. And I basically got let go from this company, and I came home at 10:30 in the morning, started calling everyone I knew. And I happened to call, yeah, mostly architects, builders, anyone I knew, saying, I'm going to start my own thing, you know, and, you know, do you have anything you could help me? And one guy said, yeah, I'm working on this museum project. We need some drafting help. Okay. 3 days later, I'm in a meeting with, you know, three other architects, and we're doing this museum project. And it was supposed to be a 3-week project. They went through a bunch of changes. It turned into, I think, 11 or 12 weeks, but it was just steady income. It wasn't that much money. When I talk about starting your own practice as a sole practitioner or being a sole practitioner, you know, sometimes you have to go there. If your work, you know, starts to dip or something, you know, when we went through the pandemic a year ago, I had a big project that was canceled, that was supposed to really be kind of the, almost a 6-month project. And I called four architects I knew, and I just, you know, told them what happened. And I said, do you need any help? You know, knowing I'm not going to make as much as I do on my own, knowing it's probably not as fulfilling as working, you know, for myself, but knowing that you have to do that. And one of the guys, we kind of do that with each other. I mean, he'll call me, you know, I'll call him, and, you know, we help each other. Sometimes I bring, you know, sometimes it's just, can you help me? I'm going to field measure a house and I really need another hand here. And, you know, he's there for me. So we kind of got a mutual kind of agreement, or, you know, where we help each other out. That's when I relaunched my practice.
And went all in as a sole practitioner, right?
I mean, yeah, went all in.
I mean, you mentioned just a few minutes ago that sometimes you end up as a sole practitioner by default, and you are now an advocate for choosing to be a sole practitioner by choice. That you have become an advocate for the sole practitioners in the profession. I have written a book called The Sole Practitioner Architect, A Guide to the Solopreneur. And you have a Facebook group now, the Sole Practitioner Architects Facebook group, and have learned and built a successful solopreneur architecture firm for yourself, and now teaching others how to do that as well. And so that story that you just told is there's lots of ups and downs and lots of lessons learned. And today, you know, I've known you a long time. You, for me, feel like you have found your place. Like this, you're comfortable with where you are. You're comfortable with the firm you've built, so much so that you want to encourage others to do similar things. And so, I wanted to have you come on the podcast and share some of that, share mm-hmm. some of your thoughts generally about being a soul practitioner and mm-hmm. choosing to be a soul practitioner. And then maybe we can, give them a few tips, a few sure. suggestions on how to do it successfully. So just generally, you know, if there are young architects out there that's starting their own firm, or somebody who's been working for somebody else for a long time and thinking about starting their own firm, and there's that question on, should I become a sole practitioner and just practice myself, or should I start a firm with the intent of growing? That's a choice, right? That's a choice that we need to make. And so what is your thought on that idea of intentionally starting as a sole practitioner?
Well, I think my first thought is that it can be a destination, and I talk about that. You know, I think a lot of people think it is just a stepping stone,
right,
you know, to something bigger. And one of the first in opening of the book, I open with this dialogue. It was at a architect's foundation Christmas party, and an older retired architect came up to me, and we introduced each other, and he said, "So who do you work for?" And I said, "Well, I work for myself." And he said, "Well, first of all, he'd never heard of me or my firm. And in Des Moines, there's, you know, maybe 40 firms. So usually people have heard of each other." And he said, "Well, how big is your firm?" And I said, "Well, it's just me." And his jaw kind of dropped. And he said, "Oh, that must be really hard.
Poor soul."
That must be really hard. And I was a little embarrassed. I didn't have a snappy comeback. You know, it's one of those, you have those George Costanza moments where he's, "I should have said this. I should have said," you know? Yep. What I should have said was, "Hey, designing and drafting isn't that hard for me. Managing people and payrolls is hard for me." Okay. So I like what I do, you know. I think back to your question too, is just kind of how do you start? And that there's no perfect way to start. There's no, you know, I mean, if you can line up work, that's great. One of the things I strongly recommend, if you don't have deep pockets, you need to be married to someone who at least has a steady income, because, you know, it cash flow can be really hard at the beginning.
A lot of ups and downs.
And, you can go through savings really easily. One thing I didn't mention was the first time I got laid off in 2007, I thought I would start my own practice again. And I went through a $25,000 line of credit in 3 months, just like that. I mean, I had no, because, the company I'd worked for had laid me off, but I thought, well, maybe it's just, their business practices or something. The phone wasn't ringing, I set myself up, got a nice office, did everything. Nice business cards, stationery, everything, ironically, I'd been freelancing kind of for a company, and they called me and said, "We want to hire you full time." And I was kind of like, "Why didn't you tell me 3 months ago? I would have done this." But there is no perfect way to start. There's an old saying I read in a practice book once. It's like, the first job is easy to get, the first project. It's usually for friends and family. The second project is tough to get. That's usually, I think there's just a lot of things you can do. And one of them is being open to, kind of consider yourself a freelancer, at least for the first year or two, that you're going to, you're going to try to line up your own projects, but at the same time, you're going to freelance for other architects.
Let's take a break to thank our sponsors for their support of this episode. BIM can be important for your next project. but it's not the only thing you need for your next project. That's why it's important that 95% of manufacturers who offer free BIM files on RCAT also offer another type of data or information that your project may need. That means 95% of the products with BIM also have CAD files, are in a specification, in a patented spec wizard, or may have product information to help you make the right selection. So stop going to a site with just BIM and go to RCAT.com to get everything you need for your next project for free and without registering. No cost, no credit card, no email, it's free. That's RCAT.com, A-R-C-A-T.com. When building a business you're passionate about, it's easy to feel like there aren't enough hours in the day. And if you're doing all the invoicing and accounting on your own, you're probably spending time on work you don't love. FreshBooks is built for business owners like us. It's the all-in-one accounting software that saves entrepreneurs and freelancers up to 11 hours a week. That's 11 hours that you could spend nailing a client pitch, designing your next project, or building your business as an architect. From preparing, sending, and following up on invoices, to tracking and managing expenses, to processing online payments, FreshBooks automates and simplifies all the tough and annoying parts of running your own business. So try FreshBooks for free for 30 days. No credit card required. Go to entrearchitect.com/FreshBooks and enter Entree Architect in the How Did You Hear About Us section and get more time back to build the business you love. That's entrearchitect.com/FreshBook. Please visit our platform sponsors today and thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. So I wanted to, I read the book and I wanted to go through some of the takeaways that you share in that book.
Yep.
Can you maybe share three or four or five takeaways that someone who wants to practice as a solopreneur can learn today, and then also know that, you know, they can buy the book and then they can dive a little bit deeper in each one of those?
Okay, well, yeah, sure. The first is, while you practice alone, you are not alone. There are a ton of sole practitioners out there. AIA salary surveys and firm surveys say that about 30% of AIA member architecture firms are one person. And then another 30% are like 2 to 5 people. So when I first saw that statistic, that kind of blew my mind, because I thought, okay, if 30% of these practices are one person, that means there's a marketplace out there for one person firms. That means it's a legitimate, business model. And if you like it, if you like, practicing your craft versus managing people, it's a legitimate way to make a living.
Yeah. And it's not the same. It's not, you can't run a sole practitioner firm the same way you run, a firm with 10 or 15 people. It's a different business. Right. And going into it, understanding that will help you be more successful. So actually sticking to the, that you're not alone, are there suggestions? First of all, I would imagine that might be one of the biggest challenges, other than the financial challenge, but let's put the financial challenge to the side for now. Is being alone, that isolation, one of the biggest challenges of being a sole practitioner architect?
It can be, I suppose. I'm very extroverted. I come to work almost all. I have an office partner. But for the first 2.5 years I did this, I was working out of the attic of my bungalow. And now probably, not every day, but I'd go have coffee with someone, or something. I also got involved in Chamber of Commerce and another kind of real estate networking group, and kind of before and after hours things would go meet people. I love meeting people.
Yeah. So you have to be intentional about getting out and meeting people and making sure that you're not in your office 24 hours a day. Although, you know, in the past year and a half, that's sort of been forced on all of us. But generally, you know, it's a great way to build into your daily schedule to make sure that you're out sort of networking and connecting with other people.
And I think our community, your community, Entree Architect, the Sole Practitioners community.
Yeah.
Shout out to our friend Enoch Sears and his business of architecture.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, we've got these communities
that
you can kind of tap in. You can, you know, vent. There's a lot of venting. You can ask questions, legitimate questions. You could share, what's been, what's worked well. You know, you had a great day. These are huge things, I think, for a sole practitioner that weren't there, years ago.
Yeah.
So it's great to have the community. I find I have to kind of turn it off and focus on work.
Exactly,
During kind of, I'll come back at noon or something. Because it can be, pretty consuming and and distracting, quite frankly. And that's, that's part of being a sole practitioner is that, if I'm not earning, if I'm not producing, there ain't no money coming in. I'm trying to say that as bluntly as I can, but, if I'm not grinding, nothing's coming in. So, I have to be really, really careful with my time. And, I can't think of it like, well, this is all kind of business development. And, I've got, four junior architects cranking out work and they're going to, making money for me. You don't have that when you're on your own.
So, although you work alone, you're not alone is the first takeaway.
Right.
The second takeaway is what? What's the next takeaway?
Looking at the SPA with sole practitioner architecture as a destination, and not a stepping stone, but as a legitimate, legitimate business. And I kind of mentioned, this, but for me, it's about practicing my craft. I was finishing up on an electrical plan this morning. I like doing BIM. I don't find it tedious or anything. I don't find it beneath me. I'm connected to my projects. I like doing everything. I really do. Not managing people and payrolls. I've kind of, mentioned that, but this can be a destination. In the book, I talk about that, but I also, at the end of the book, I say, well, things change, things evolve. You might, do this for 5 years, 8 years or something. And then there's a change. It could happen to me. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm not counting on it, but
it's a choice to start your practice that way. And, I often asked architects to prepare a business plan with an idea of, what's the next 3 years look like. But I always say that plan is just a map, right? It's a check-in. So when those opportunities come, you have an opportunity to go back to that plan and say, is this an opportunity that I want to pursue or not? And so it's very similar where if you choose to become a sole practitioner architect and this other opportunity comes along, that plan gives you that check, right? Do I want to continue to be a sole practitioner architect or do I want to take this opportunity? You and I are similar ages. We've started our practices or our careers around the same time. We know that it's a journey, right? It's this up and down and different routes and different opportunities come along and there is no straight line. It just doesn't exist. It's this curvy, squiggly line. It goes up and down and side and back and forth. And with a plan, you can sort of end up somewhere where you'd love to be, it very, very rarely is it a straight line. So you're not alone. It's a destination. You could, practicing as a sole practitioner architect could be a destination, should be a destination if that's what you're choosing. You should commit to it. So what's your third takeaway?
Seeing the SPA model as an asset.
What
not a liability. Well, this comes from probably you know the weakness of this model, and it's probably obvious, but I'll state it, is that I don't have two or three draftsmen that can jump on something and crank something out so you'll have it by Wednesday. I don't have that. I really take the time to, before I we sign an agreement with a client, to educate them on that. But I also emphasize, here's the upside of it. Here's the upside of it. You're going to get me in my 25 years of experience on every aspect of your project. Here in Des Moines, we don't have a lot of small firms. Big cities like Chicago had, just a ton of small firms. So there's a lot of, Des Moines pretty much has mid-sized firms. There's not a lot of large firms, but they're, 20, 30 people firms. And they get a small project. Generally, it goes to their, I'm going to call them interns, but they're, the recent graduates. Or someone like that. That's who's going to work. So, I tell prospective clients, you're going to get me. You're not going to get, someone who's, who's doing this as a summer job. And here we got a little addition. We do sports facilities, but, a friend asked us to do an addition. Here's your project. You get me. And, I also take the time to point out that because probably half of my, two-thirds of my residential is that kind of major renovation, major addition, whole house. These projects are not easy. I mean, I've been doing them for 25 years, and they are not no-brainers. They're not easy. This is your house. Who do you want to entrust that to? Because they are not easy. You can spend a ton of money and build a flawed addition. So,
right.
The asset is you're getting all that experience on your small project.
Yeah. And that becomes part of your brand, becomes part of your story. It becomes part of your differentiation when a client is considering you versus someone else. You want to highlight that it is an asset. It's an opportunity to work directly with the decision maker and the person that has the 25 years of experience rather than, working with a larger firm that, may have more resources, but you're not going to get somebody with 25 years of experience to do a residential addition. So it's an asset. You can look at it that way and present it that way. So do you have any more? Do you have any other takeaways?
Yeah, a couple more. I'll say it's a lifestyle business.
What does that mean?
It really means embracing what it is and what it is not, and for me, it gets back to, do you want to practice the craft or not? I know I have friends, architects who have worked for, large and mid-sized firms. They are used to working in teams. They are used to working on large projects. They thrive on that. This pretty much isn't that. And I want to just, as a little side note, I'm talking about the what I call the traditional sole practitioner architect. In my book, we have some case studies of other models where someone may work for themselves, but they use a lot of, they do bigger projects with contractors, or, someone might even do, just pure consulting for other architects. I knew an architect in Oak Park that did stone cladding. He was the stone cladding expert, and the firms downtown would go to him, and it was, he was still a sole practitioner. I'm talking about the traditional sole practitioner model, where you are, basically, doing everything and not really relying, maybe once in a while relying on contract help, but you're doing everything. And right. So it's a lifestyle.
Would you say, Edward, that a part of that idea of it being a lifestyle is that you have a little bit more flexibility and freedom to sort of schedule the rest of your life integrated into that business that you can sort of design your life a little bit more? You have less of a set schedule where you have to be in a chair for a certain number of hours.
Sure, certainly.
You can do what you want to do when you want to do it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes. And I think, you know, those of us who are, you know, self-employed in any profession, like, you know, I mean, we probably work more than we, you know, or as much as we did when we worked for other companies, but we're not, you know, kind of tied to the clock. You know, it is that, you know, my kids are grown, but if, you know, I'm going to go to my kid's soccer game today at 4, but I'm going to, you know, take my laptop home and I'm going to, you know, open it up at 8 o'clock and work on this, you know, that type of thing. There, you know, flex times there. I'm going to say this, probably has to be said. Part of the lifestyle is, generally speaking, you will probably not make the same as a principal in a large firm. Okay.
Yeah.
And I can keep going with that and saying, well, you know, as an architect, you might not make as much as a developer or someone in construction.
Yeah,
so, but, you know, but we all kind of make the choice.
You when
know.
You're working for yourself and you are the sole practitioner, there is a ceiling. You can only take on so much work. You can only complete so much work. And you can get very efficient at that and you can max it out to the best of its ability, but it will hit a ceiling and it will be what it is. And so there's some sacrifice to it, but there are also lots of, you know, non-financial benefits, right? That also play into that, which is what I was just talking about, more and more integrated life with your family and your friends and your children and all the other things that come along in your lives. And so the money is potentially limited. And you just have to sort of accept that's, you know, that's part of making this choice, that if you're working alone, you're going to hit a ceiling. And really the only way to make more is to get better at what you do, right? Be more efficient, more effective, build a better brand.
There's that. I think you're talking about a couple different things there, Mark. But you had Seth Godin on a few weeks ago, and he talked about, as a writer, he's a freelancer, and that he said a lot of architects, he called us freelancers. But he said, you know, you don't make more money by getting quicker and better. You don't make more money by hiring a lot of production, doing more work. You get more money by getting better clients.
Yes.
And that is my goal. That is how I am choosing to grow my practice. I've had a few of these really good clients. I want more of them. I want nothing but them.
Right.
I want to be able to, you know, to turn the, you know, turn away, you know, the ones that, you know, don't want, and I will, I won't have to turn them away. They'll, you know, when I quote them a fee, they'll say, yeah, I'll talk to my wife and get back to you, you know? And, that, you know, I don't want to look at it like, you know, there's this cap, there's this ceiling.
You're exactly right. Thank
never,
you.
We can never get beyond it. Yeah. And, you know, whatever you're making and you're, by the time you're working steadily doing this thing, it's never going to get any better. I talk about growing inward in the book, you know, versus growing outward. And growing inward is, you know, getting better clients, getting better projects, being able to, you know, get people who really appreciate you, who are willing to pay you more.
Yeah. Thank you for that clarification. You're absolutely right. And that really goes back to branding, right? That's telling the right story, building a brand that attracts those specific clients and not attract the clients that, you know, are looking for a cheap project. And so there are ways to earn more. And I just want a clarification. Seth Godin was on the Context and Clarity podcast, not Entree Architect. We had them. Yeah. We had him at the Entree Architect Facebook group. It was simulcast there. And that's what you're referencing is the Context and Clarity podcast, which if you're listening, you should go subscribe. That's our other podcast with Jeff Eccles. So we have time for one more takeaway.
Well,
what's the final takeaway?
The last one I have for is you have to chart your own course. And this is something when I meet with young architects, I'm I'm an alum of Iowa State. I was part of a fraternity. Every now and then, the chapter advisor gets a hold of, you know, will email and say, you know, we've got a couple of architects. Are you able to hire any of them? And I'll say, no, it's just me. I'm not going to hire anyone, but I can, you know, I can certainly have lunch with a guy and talk to him about, you know, yeah, where to go with this crazy profession. And I kind of came up with a little, you know, formula that I wished I had followed. I didn't. But, you know, it's basically, I tell them, you know, first of all, you know, chart your own course. Who do you work for? You work for you. That's who you work for. You work for you, period. You are in charge of this, you know, of charting your course in kind of, you know, a rocky sea. I mean, architecture is, you know, it's not a lineal profession. It can be. I'm reading Patrick McCleary's HOK bio, and you know, here's a guy that started with a firm and grew with it. The firm grew, and you know, it can be. But more and more, I think, you know, due to the nature of, you know, how many small practices there are, you know, a lot of people, you go to work for a firm and it's a 6-person firm. Well, you're not going to become a partner one day, or it's very unlikely. So you have to chart your own course. So I came up with this little formula. Basically, you know, in your 20s, you graduate, you get your degree. That's the time to explore. Try working at a large firm, small firm. Try different things out. Your 30s, you focus. Okay, you've spent your 20s exploring different career paths. You've discovered your strengths and how they can best be utilized. Now it's time to choose a path and focus your efforts so that when you reach your 40s, you can be anchored, okay? Now, I kind of did that in my career. I wanted to get into education, but I didn't have a real clear path how to get there. And you know, this formula works well when everything is working. But, you know, I've been through two major recessions. And I can tell you that when you're in, you know, when you're in the midst of that, you're more or less just surviving, no matter who you are.
Yeah.
And you may not get to work for who you want to, or, you know, or you may have a huge detour in life. But, you know, basically, you work for yourself. Think of that. You're always working for yourself, and you're always thinking about how are you going to get to that place you want to be. If you want to work for a large firm, you know, try it out. I worked for an international 650 person firm in my 20s, hated it. But at least I tried it. You know, I know what it's like to work for one of those places. Try these things out in your 20s, focus in your 30s so you can be anchored in your 40s.
Yeah, that's very good advice. I think that's a great framework for anybody starting their career, is to look at it that way in terms of sort of decades, that your 20s are all about exploring and taking chances and taking those risks that will be much more difficult to take as you get older and become a little bit more established and, you know, potentially have families. Those things get more difficult. So 20s are a great time to explore. And it gives you permission to sort of take those risks and not, you know, and not be so much in a rush to be rooted when you're 20, right? When you're in your 20s, go out there and have fun, learn as much as you can, explore as much as you can, try all those different places. And so then in your 30s, you can start focusing. And so in your 40s, you'll have a really good, strong foundation.
And I want to just say one last thing about that.
Yeah.
You may find yourself in your 40s or your 50s and you're not grounded. You know, maybe you got laid off, or, you know, or you've just had a success. You know, you're not in the place. I just want to say, you're better than you think you are. Probably you went to architecture school, you got a license and you've got experience. If you can, you know, maybe you start doing a sole practice, and and I'm speaking to, you know, maybe the guy who's never done, you know, residential before, and you know, there's kind of a perception that it's easier, I don't think it is, but you'll learn it, you know, and you can learn it because you know, architects aren't dummies. I mean, they're not, you know?
Yep.
And so, you know, you're capable of learning and, you know, you can kind of take control of, you know, if you find yourself in a place that's not real desirable,
you know,
it's, and I'm living proof of that. So,
and that goes back to your first takeaway that you're not alone. So if you do find yourself in that position where you're sort of, you know, floating out in the sea and you're not grounded, you're not rooted, you're not grounded, you're not sure, find a group, find a community, find people who you can connect with, because those are the people that will help you find your destination. Find one of these groups, join Entree Architect community, join the Soul Practitioner Architects community, and find a group of people who are in similar places, who may have been in similar places as you, and it will help you. So Ed, excellent takeaways. Thank you for that. Before we wrap up, I wanted to ask you the one question that we ask everybody. So what is one thing, if we needed to focus on one thing that a small firm architect could take away today to build a better business for tomorrow, what would that one thing be?
Well, I didn't mention this, but it would be to have a business or a financial plan, really to have that. We get asked a lot in these forums, you know, how much should I charge? And boy, that's a loaded question, you know, and it really, if you've really gone through the exercise of creating a financial plan, and it really has to tie into a household budget. You know, so you know how much, you know, I talk about how much you want to make, how much you need to make.
Yeah.
You know, there's a big difference between those. And, you know, at the very least, you need to know what you need to make. So have a business plan.
Yeah, very good advice. And you actually give them a framework in the book. So if you are looking for a simple framework on how to put together a financial plan, get the book because it talks all about it. His name is Edward Shannon. The firm is Edward J. Shannon Architect. You can learn more about his architecture firm at edwardjshannon.com. You can learn more about Solo Architects and Sole Practitioner Architects at soloarchitect.org. You can also learn more about the book there. You can join the Facebook group at Soul Practitioner Architects. You could search for it on Facebook, Soul Practitioner Architects. We'll have a link on that as well on the show notes. The book, if you wanted to purchase the book, it's called The Soul Practitioner Architect. You hear a theme here, The Soul Practitioner Architect, a guide for the solopreneur. We'll have a link to that as well. You can buy that on Amazon. And I highly recommend it if you are a soul practitioner or if you are someone considering a soul practitioner business, you should go buy that book. It helps you get all of your different sort of your ducks in a row, right? It sort of talks about the whole experience and how to put together a soul practitioner business. Edward, thank you. Thank you not only for coming here today on the podcast, but thank you for your dedication to the profession. Thank you for being such an active contributing member of the Entree Architect community since the very beginning. And thank you for starting your own community and starting your own passion for soul practitioner architects and leading that community. We need people like you in this profession to lead, to take a step and say, okay, I'm going to be out there and be there for others. And I appreciate you for doing that. So thank you for that and for being part of this podcast today at Entree Architect Podcast.
Thank you too, Mark. And like, I'm thankful for everything, you know, folks like you and Enoch Sears have and Jeff, you know, everyone who's really helping small practices because, you know, there just wasn't a lot out there. So very thankful.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you, Ed. If you liked this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a rating, write a review, and share a link to this episode with a friend. That's how you could help grow Entree Architect Podcast. Thank you to our sponsors, Arcat and FreshBooks, for their support of this episode. Links to all our sponsors and all our resources that we discussed today are available at the show notes for this episode found at entrearchitect.com/podcast. Entree Architect is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network. Gable Media is curated thought leadership for an audience dedicated to building a better world. That's you. Listen and subscribe to all the shows at gablemedia.com. That's gablemedia.com. Go there now. And check out Entree Architect Academy membership. Ready to edit business resources for architects, live monthly business training for architects, a supportive architect community, and Simple Systems, our new business system program developed for you, the small firm entrepreneur architect. It's all waiting for you right now at Entree Architect Academy membership, including AIA Continuing Education Learning Units. Yep, they're there too. Entree Architect is there for you. Come join me and hundreds of your entrepreneur architect friends. Visit entrearchitect.com/join to enroll today. Thanks for listening today. Love, learn, and share what you know.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and this sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure, and when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark Arlepage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.